Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Karina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Helga Nowotny about the new book, In AI We Trust, Power, Illusion, and Control of Predictive Algorithms. One of the most persistent concerns about the future is whether it will be dominated by the predictive algorithms or of AI. And if so, what this will mean for our behavior, for our institutions, and for what it means to be human. As we try to adjust to a world in which algorithms, robots, and avatars play an ever-increasing role, we need to understand better the limitations of AI and how their predictions affect our agency, while at the same time having the courage to embrace the uncertainty of the future.
Well, Helga, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
It's great to have you here with us today. So I would like to start by asking, how has pandemic influenced you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience?
Well, it influenced me by reinforcing the importance of the topic, because I had been thinking about AI and predictive algorithm for some time. And then when the pandemic hit, I was really taken aback because I felt myself now, you know, in the midst of what was happening. And as many of us experienced, on the one hand, all the digital technologies that surround us were kind of lifesavers or safety boys, whatever you want to call them, because they got us out of isolation. I mean, we cannot imagine even what these various lockdowns would have been like without digital technologies. And on the other hand, it showed very clearly the importance of having our bodies in the real world and not just in the digital world. And if you move too much into the digital world, it does something with your body and your body resents it. So this was a kind of interesting personal experience also, working on a topic and then you feel it the way how it impacts you. Otherwise, you know, like many people working in academia, we were in a very privileged position because we had space at home. We were used to work at home. So this was nothing new for us. And of course, like many others, you know, I also used the time for writing. So from this point of view, I can only say it had its advantageous sides for me as well. But I also participated in a book project that came out. This was Gerald Delanti, who was the editor, Pandemics, Politics and Society. So I was also in touch with other authors, colleagues who were contributing to the book during that period, which made also for an interesting scholarly exchange on what we were experiencing.
You yourself, how did you find adjusting to lack of travel, perhaps?
Well, you know, on the personal side, because I was separated from my partner for 3 months, because travel was virtually, crossing borders was virtually impossible. And so this was the hard part. But then we found ways of filling out travel forms. And, you know, we became rather experts in which travel forms you had to fill out to be able to cross borders. So that was the hardest part for me.
Can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Well, let me start with my present position. As you know, I am a professor emerita of ETH Zurich, so not very far from where you are now. And I'm also the former president of the European Research Council. And I remain, of course, very much attached to the years that I spent building up the European Research Council. Unfortunately, as you know, Switzerland is in a limbo now and does no longer participate. I hope that it will be resolved one way or the other, but in a good way for Swiss researchers. So this is where I am right now. I'm also the chair or member of a number of scientific advisory boards. So I keep in touch with the academic world around me. I always have been also interested and engaged in policy work. So this continues. And otherwise, I try to make sense of, you know, what technology does with us and what we do with technology. And digital technologies are fascinating from this point of view because it's a very potent and a very rapidly developing new technology that really pervades all of our, all facets of our life. It's the personal life, if you think of fitness bands, you know, and monitoring not only our physiological parameters, but also there are algorithms and sensors that try to measure the mood we are in. And from the personal side, you can clearly see how much we accept, appropriate these technologies, but also how they invade our personal life. And I was always taken a bit aback when I heard people say, you know, by now the algorithm knows me better than myself. And I thought, no, I don't want any algorithm to know myself better than I do myself. But this is just one example how much it has become part of our personal life. And then, of course, you can clearly see what happens in the workplace, although there, you know, developments are still very much in progress, but we can see also how quickly professional work is becoming invaded by algorithms, by AI, how it changes the workplace. It's not just the automation of factories that has been going on for many years, of course, but also the way how science works. We have some fantastic new tools in science. If you think of protein folding, when I think back of my time at ETH Zurich, you know, this was one of the hot topics by one of my colleagues in the natural sciences. So, you know, it's all over the place. And therefore, you know, I find it fascinating trying to make sense. What does it do to us and what do we do with it? The problem I faced is that there is an enormous amount of literature. And the literature I found is divided. You have on the one side all these utopian or nerd-like celebrations. It will solve all of our problems. It's innovation, it's the disruptive technology that we have been looking for, and it will solve all our problems. And on the other side, you have the dystopian camp, if I can call it that, of people who are warning. I mean, if you think of Shoshana Zuboff's book, Surveillance Capitalism, that made quite an impact because she showed in detail how much this collusion between users giving up their data and even very intimate data to the large corporations for the sake of convenience. You know, you get services, you get the information very quickly, you get the recommendations that you're looking for, etc. On the other hand, the specter of surveillance, be it by the state, which is always possible, or by companies. And so I had to find a way not to fall into this trap of a polarization, you know, the utopian views and dystopian views, because I think we have to overcome this kind of dichotomous thinking. So this was where, in a way, where I started. Then I, you know, I went to conferences, I talked to people working with AI, etc. And then I got really fascinated by predictive algorithms. And since I have been working before in my previous professional life, I've been always working on the topic of time and the future and how our concept of the future changes. So this became one entry point. And the other entry point, which is somehow connected with this, is the topic of uncertainty. I wrote a book just 5 or 6 years ago, The Cunning of Uncertainty, where I tried to deconstruct uncertainty. And just, you know, it's not just something that we have to be afraid of, quite to the contrary. We have to learn how to live with uncertainty, and it has many positive sides. So this all came together. And then I started writing, and the pandemic helped me in having time to concentrate and to focus.
So your latest book, In AI We Trust, Power, Illusion, and Control of Predictive Algorithms. So you already explained how you approached it. So why did you, what did you want to achieve in it?
Well, I wanted, as the subtitle says, I wanted to show where does its power come from? Why do we allow it to have this power over us? But then also, of course, thinking about the illusions that we think we can now control better our future, that we can predict, or our future is predicted for us, and of course, how to manage it. And at the heart of my book is what I call a paradox, because predictive algorithms allow us to increase control over uncertainty and over the future, because it allows us to see further. But at the same time, we attribute agency to these predictive algorithms. We treat them as though they can actually predict, while what they do is to extrapolate from the past, but somehow, you know, we get the feeling they know the future, or they know us, what we will do in the future, better than us. And this transfer of agency makes us act in ways in which the algorithm predicts, and that reduces our agency. So this is a somewhat lengthy explanation, but I think the gist of the paradox is, on the one hand, it lets us see further, but if we believe that the algorithm has too much power, that it can actually predict the future, which is not the case. If we forget about probabilities in which all these predictions are couched, then we relinquish agency. So this is what I try to show. And then, of course, there are many other sort of facets or dimensions to it. I became interested in the origins. I became interested in the coincidence with the Anthropocene. I have one chapter on the mirror world that we are creating, and how we move in this mirror world, and also one chapter that is entitled Future Needs Wisdom. And this title was taken from a haiku that I wrote when I was coming back from a conference. This is a little story which may be of interest also to our listeners. This was a conference where the organizers decided to have an AI write haikus for the different breakout groups. And instead of saying this is group A, B, C, and D, each group got a different haiku, and the haiku was composed by an algorithm, which is very easy. And I think the first haiku was already produced in the 70s. So it's not something very spectacular, but so we got these haikus. And my haiku did not make a lot of sense to me. So in the on my way back, I was sitting in the plane and I thought, well, I also want to write a haiku. If the AI can do it, I can perhaps do it better. And the last line of my little haiku was, "Future needs wisdom." And this was a line that somehow stuck with me. And then I made it the title of a chapter where I speak also about ethics and things of this kind. So this is a very brief overview of what the book is about and what it contains.
So let's delve into some of the concepts that you cover in your book. And let me start with the easiest one. So what is an AI?
Well, I use digitalization, AI, machine learning, deep learning, neural networks as a kind of umbrella term. So there are, of course, the technical definitions. We don't have to go into them. But I think the way how I treat it is as an ensemble where it all comes together. We need infrastructures, digital infrastructures, for it to make to work at all, to be able to operate. We need computational power. We need ever more sophisticated algorithms that need to be trained. Some are not trained and learn by themselves, but others need to be trained. And for this, we need data. So the three most important components are data, algorithms, and computational power. So the question is, how fast can an algorithm come up with solutions that you have to predefine? Of course, you have to tell the algorithm what kind of solutions you're looking for, but you need data. And now there is an enormous amount of data available of different kinds, et cetera. And I'm, of course, particularly interested in the kind of data that come from the social world, from the way how people behave, the kind of data they give to the large companies, and how this acts upon us and makes us then behave in certain ways, where these algorithms and their predictions can become self-fulfilling prophecies. And then people start to behave in the way how the prediction tells them to behave. And this is a well-known phenomenon in sociologies. It's known since the 1940s of the last century. Now, we are surrounded by these algorithms. And so what is AI? I would say, it's a very powerful technology that is made up of these different component parts, data, computation, power, algorithm, and of course, the people who design and operate them. Let's not forget them. It's not technology, it's never technology alone. And it's people, and there are users, there are owners, there are companies, there is the state, and when we speak and think about ethics, the question of regulation comes up: who regulates it, etc. So it's a kind of very complex ensemble.
And more we understand that it's a very intimate dance between humans and technology as we move forward, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the word dance is a very nice way. The question is, who sets the music, who sets the tone? And with the dance, you have someone who leads, someone who follows, but you also have creative forms of dancing. So the term I use is that of co-evolution, because I think in the long term, we get more and more into some kind of entanglement with these technologies. I mentioned already fitness bands. So, you know, there are people who go to sleep with them, with the sensors, and they never think they should let the sensors off their bodies at some point. So it's this kind of intimate relationship that they enter. But we also have the kind of co-evolution. If you think of robots, and robots are not only the ones, you know, the social robots that look more or less like humans, or they want to try to look, but they should not look too much like humans. But also there are tiny little robots inserted into our bodies, for instance, to deliver drugs to organs, etc. So all this is part of how we incorporate this technology into our body on the surface, but also in our body and, of course, around us, if you think of the environment. And by now, we have very powerful sensors in satellites, in drones, etc., that are able to monitor. They are also able to kill, as we know. Autonomous weapons is one of the most dangerous developments in this field. But we can also use them to look, for instance, how far has deforestation progressed in certain parts of the world, etc. So it's in us, it's with us, it's between us, but it's also in our environment. And this is why I speak about a co-evolution. And it's an open-ended process, like evolution is open-ended.
So how does the digitization differ across the world? Do some cultures have it in slightly different ways, how they perceive it?
Yes, I mean, one striking example is social robots in Japan. Japan started very early in the field of robotics, and perhaps because they were one of the earliest society that was an aging society. So the society not reproducing themselves, and since Japan is not an immigration-friendly country, so the aging society was felt very early on. And there are various ideas why in Japan these robots are accepted socially. They are treated as something in the middle between a member of the family and a pet is a member of the family, etc. So this is one cultural exception. While in many other cultures, you know, people hesitate. They think that social robots to take care of the elderly, for instance, is something that dehumanizes elderly people, etc. And so there are these cultural differences. But I also see differences across the world that are related to politics and the way how state and industry function, if you think of the way how AI is regulated. And here we have the US, where state regulation is not very favorably looked upon. You have very strong lobbies against state regulation with the argument this stifles innovation. So it will, you know, undermine the dominance that American companies, the big ones like Microsoft, Google, etc., have in the world. You have China, where the state sets the rules and the state regulates everything, including facial recognition, etc., social credit that still does not quite work the way the government wants it to work, but nevertheless. And the EU or Europe trying somewhere in the middle with the Data Protection Regulation Act and the new AI Act. So I think regulation also shows it's partly, of course, you can say culture, but it's also a lot that has to do with the way how politics looks and appropriates and works with this AI or allows. In Europe, we always appeal to the European values. So facial recognition is looked upon as something that is to be avoided, etc., and a more liberal or libertarian economic attitude that you find in the US.
And what are the bigger ethical debates that surround AI?
Well, you know, you cannot start a debate on AI without ethics coming up as a topic. And everyone thinks that ethics is the solution. The problem is we don't have an agreement on what kind of ethical AI we want, what is technically feasible, because it's not so easy, but also how it will be implemented, updated, etc. And there was an interesting study that was done by a group at ETH Zurich, looking at official documents, almost 100 official documents, half of them coming from governments on guidelines for ethical AIs, and the other half by corporations. And what was found that you had no agreement in these almost 100 documents which principles make an AI an ethical AI. And the one principle that came closest in something like 50 or 60 of these guidelines was that of transparency. But it shows the enormous difficulties. We all want an ethical AI, but it shows the difficulties. What do we mean by transparency? How do you make sure that transparency can actually be embedded and technologically embedded, which is, of course, otherwise it's useless, can be monitored. And then, as with every regulation, you always have the problem, how do you update it? Because the technology becomes more sophisticated, the technology can circumvent what the lawmaker or the ethicists want. So we have an enormous ongoing debates there, which of course is necessary, but on the other hand, we have very little agreement and we have not made that much progress, I would say. And this is why I came up with this idea, maybe we need wisdom. And by wisdom, I mean that we have to look much more into the social context in which the AI is being used, for which it is being designed, where it is being used, and also the way how people use it.
So it sounds like it's a matter of really differentiating of what kind of performance AI is built for. So for example, if it's manufacturing or social robot or cleaner robot, they would have different sort of approaches to how they can be regulated.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this means to go into the social context. And this is the kind of attitude, the ethos that I think needs to be adopted if we want to, be able to somehow come closer to the feeling we can put at least some of our values, some of the ideas that we have, what should be done, what should not be done into this technology, rather than just letting it run wild or let the big companies decide on what they deem to be acceptable or not.
So what are the some AI developments that really excite you nowadays?
Well, I follow very closely developments in science. And there, I think, you know, it's great. And if you think now of the James Webb Space Telescope, you know, it's just amazing what we are able to do to send this telescope to look for the origins of galaxies millions of light years away. All this would be impossible without AI. So this is just, you know, my enthusiasm is being excited by this because I find it really amazing. But closer to everyday concerns, what is interesting is also the way how you know, people try to find their own way. And here you have youngsters who are enthusiastic about the technology, but at the same time, some become critical. We have all these ongoing discussions about fake news, the social media, etc., where fake news per se are nothing new, but they circulate very widely. So all these are, let's say, ambivalent, you know, developments that make life challenging, interesting. And I think it really poses the question to us, how are we redefining what makes us human?
So where do you see field progressing from here?
Well, you know, going the progress that I see on, I mean, it's the development is really a very fast development everywhere, and it's difficult to make any predictions, as I said. But where I see and I hope that AI will be able to support efforts is in the area of the environment and climate change. We need good models, and here AI can help us in order to understand better these very complex systems. If you think of the interactions between atmosphere and oceans and how they impact the climate, etc. So here I would say it's an enormous field in which AI is very much needed and where we face enormous challenges and urgency to do something. So this I would say is something that I hope that we will have a good use of AI in this area.
So do you think we also need a better education of people about AI?
Definitely. I mean, critical thinking, how to use it, and critical thinking in terms not just of understanding, because technology can be understood only up to a certain degree because it's in a black box still. But for young people, I think it's important to teach them how to ask critical questions and critical thinking. But then I think also it offers some interesting new ways of involving people by letting them participate in simulation models. Simulation models make predictions, but the predictions are based on the assumptions, what if? And this is something that people, that everyone can understand. You make certain assumptions, so it can be very simple, and then you see what will be the outcome. And this is something that you can bring to people, you know, down to the everyday level, if you have, in urban design, or if you have questions about the environment, a little bit of citizen science in this direction. You can get people to understand, given certain assumptions, you will have certain consequences. You never will know all the consequences, but certain ones you can see with certain probabilities. And I think this would be a very important educational tool also, both in schools, but also for people, you know, everyday life, where you can find out, well, what if? And many people, we see this also now in the pandemic and all the discussions about vaccinations. Many people don't understand what are probabilities. Yeah, and then people say, yes, but I know someone who has been 3 times vaccinated and the person got sick or the person died. Yeah. Then you say, well, there is no 100% assurance of anything in the world. So I think to use simulation models and the what-if constellation would be a very valuable educational tool.
The question on many people's mind nowadays is, should we be fearful of AI? What would be your answer?
Well, fear is never a good strategy, I would say. You know, fear pushes you back into a corner where you want to protect yourself against a force that you find overpowering. So I don't think we have to be afraid of it, but we have to be able... when I speak about in the title, In AI, We Trust, it's of course a word play of In God We Trust. As you know, this is the American motto written on the dollar. But at the same time, it's a bit tongue in cheek because we should not trust it too much. So on the one hand, we can trust it, but at the same time, we should not trust it too much. And to find this line that has to be negotiated and renegotiated, I think this is one of the messages that I would like to send out with the book.
Now, thinking about the bigger picture, and you already mentioned some of it, so do you think AI will be integral to our ability to solve some of the biggest problems and challenges for the future?
Definitely. I think it has an enormous potential for that. But, again, we have to be careful not to believe there are only technological fixes, because these are shortcuts and the technology will never exist to solve all of our environmental problems. So again, we have to ask ourselves the question, in which way can we use AI to monitor, to ask, to put it into simulation models? Which data are we using? We have to start to work with it and to work carefully with it instead of being afraid. And therefore, I think the potential is enormous to help us because it allows us to see further. But we never should forget this depends on the data that come from the past. We don't have data from the future. The data are from the past. We need high quality data. This is also something that politicians, decision makers have to learn. Data are an important part of it, but we need to look at the quality, just as with food. You know, we don't want to eat anything. We want to have high quality food. So we need also high quality data.
And what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, In AI We Trust, surprised you the most?
I was surprised to discover the ease or naivete with which people believe the predictions of an AI. And it reminded me of the times when people were using oracles. You know, in every civilization in the history of humankind, there were priests or shamans or divinatory practitioners using oracles to make predictions. And somehow the way how people approach the predictions of AI reminded me of this magic past or belief in magic that that humans had in the past. While now we think, well, you know, we are all highly developed technological scientific civilization, so we have left magic behind us. But I was surprised a bit of these residues is still very much alive.
Such an important point that, as with any new technology, we should approach it with some pragmatism and skepticism.
Absolutely. I fully agree.
So imagine that you could have any sci-fi AI. What would it be?
Well, I don't think I'm a good sci-fi writer, but there are some sci-fi writers that I think very highly of, and one is Ursula Le Guin. And she's no longer alive, but she was a great writer. And what she tried with her writing is to enlarge the imagination, but the imagination with a purpose of how can we build a better society. And so if I were only half as gifted as Ursula Le Guin, you know, I would try to write sci-fi in order to, you know, unleash our imagination. What would a better society look like and how could we ever get there?
Well, this has been a really insightful discussion. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Well, you know, once you finish a book, you don't want to immediately embark on the next one. But of course, there are ideas and concerns and interesting problems. And they turn around the big question, how can we understand societal transformations? We are now in the second year of this pandemic, and we experience there is no return back to the life as it was before. There are transformations that have shown us the deep inequalities in society. They have shown us cleavages in society that we never, you know, thought of that they existed, etc. And there are interesting other transformations going on towards, you know, the green transformation, etc. And we have personal experience of this. We have also modeling, a complex systems modeling, but we understand very little how do these processes actually work. So this is a big question, and I'm just standing at the beginning of it and trying to do a little bit more in this direction.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, go to my homepage, which is easy to find. And for the book, you just Google it, and it's available.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, and I very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.